This is After Dark number 5. This is tape number 10, and this is side 2. Well, as our good friend Rush Limbaugh would say, as he slaps his paper, or perhaps even the G-Man would bring you the news behind news from the Washington... I thought I'd read some news out of different publications that I receive and some interesting stories that I happened upon in different publications. First of all, let's talk about pagers. Don't you just hate it when your pager goes off at dinner time? Well, in Texas, you'll find a rancher who uses beepers attached to cattle to call them in for dinner. The pagers are attached to several select cows in the herd. Once beeped, this group rounds up the rest of the 100-head herd to grab some grub, says Nelson Roberts, vice president and general manager of Arlington, Texas-based telephone warehouse, which handles the pager installation. The Dallas rancher simply dials a group dispatch number that sets off the multiple-tone Motorola Express pagers, Roberts explains. There are three different tones on the pager, and some cattle have one tone, and some have another, he continues. The minute you can get one or two cows to start heading back towards the barn, then all the cows will follow. Training the cattle to associate the pager tones with feeding didn't take long, says Roberts. The pagers are weatherized with batteries that typically last about a month. A dial-tone cowboy's lifestyle is a defined departure from the freewheeling cattle drives of the Old West. He can sit in the living room of his home, watch the head of cattle, which are probably a half a mile or a mile away, says Roberts. He can dial a number from his desk in his office and then watch the herd start back toward the barn. That news comes from America's Network magazine and was via the SBE chapter number 28 up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We've kind of made a few comments at times talking about how the engineers are being phased out at radio stations. An interesting article also in the SB magazine from Chapter 28 of Madison, Wisconsin. Broadcast engineering becomes media technical support. Excerpts from a luncheon speech made by Terry Bond, SBE National Vice President, to Madison Broadcaster Clinic attendees on Tuesday, November 8th of 1994. This was edited by Paul Stuffel. Back in these good old days, broadcast engineering was a rock. It was perhaps the only position in broadcasting that promised and delivered the kind of job security that our brothers and sisters in the industry could only dream about. The federal government told our managers and owners that we were not only useful, but necessary to the legal operation of their station. Then a funny thing happened to the definition of our professional about 10 years ago. It went away. You and I now have a new job description, one that is far more broad and far more challenging than the old one. We now spend more time planning for and installing equipment than fixing it. We now spend even more time training folks to use equipment that formerly was hands-off to everyone except engineers. We're more eager to network with other engineers about how to get the job done rather than hiding our handiwork from each other. And we spend more time maintaining and managing the internal telecommunications system within our broadcast plants. We are getting out of the broadcast engineering business and into the communications management business. We are being asked to expand our horizons and do two things that traditionally engineers were never accused of, being good business people and embracing change. You might think of the transition like this. We were broadcast engineers. We are now broadcast technology managers. We are becoming media technical support managers. Whether you are a staff engineer, a chief, a director of engineering, or a contract engineer, you are in the business of managing media and communications technology profitably and efficiently. By taking the time to seek out new and better ways of doing your job, learning more about the technologies you work with now and in the future, you are preparing to better serve your customers, the people who actually give up time or money to be entertained and informed by the organizations that you work for. I say this can be a great business if we learn how to work with managers and help to solve their problems. Think how valuable a engineering department can be when it plays an important role in holding down costs and providing non-sales revenues. you be one to make engineering budget adjustments. Part of your new job as a technical manager is to show your superiors what you do is vitally important to the fiscal health of the broadcast enterprise. It is important that you not only be on the management committee, but also be part of the management team. We as broadcasters must not fail to see the larger picture of media and data transmissions and find our place within. This new media technology is based upon the efficient use of data transmission systems. It is important to attain a basic comfort level when using PCs, modems, and data transmission technology. The future success of our careers as media technical support managers will be determined by our overall vision of the transmission process. In the future, you are far more likely to have a local area network analyzer in your toolkit than a Simpson Model 260. You are far more likely to spend more time on the phone and faxing getting equipment repaired than in the shop actually using a soldering iron. Board swapping will become the standard repair procedure. What becomes critical then is having the knowledge of what spares to keep on the shelf. You are far more likely to be working with Ma Bell, the cable companies, the satellite folks, as equal partners in an enterprise rather than as vendors, or worse yet, the competition. Get to know other technologies and other technicians. Your ability to respond quickly to requests for technical information will be valued. You will be the resource called upon when decisions need to be made upon technologies that are about to be purchased. Our business is the business of data transmission. Our business is, and always has been, getting data out to the customer. We just thought of it as radio or TV. In the future, that will change. One of the striking aspects of broadcast television is that it has caught on so fast and reached its heyday so rapidly. Now imagine combining television with the aspects of multimedia education, two-way communications, interactive video, and home shopping, and voting, and guess how long it will take before a PC-based media center is a majority of a U.S. living room. And when we are in charge of the transmission plant, whose receiver is a PC? Just what business will we be in then? The changes in our industry, while coming at a rapid pace, still do not obsolete the basic analytical and troubleshooting skills that we all depend upon every day. Ohm's Law remains Ohm's Law, even in a digital universe. Electrons in motion will still represent the core of our industry. But we must remember that our engineering tasks evolve more than just directing those electron flows. We need to be thinking of new ways in which to manage those systems to be even more efficient conveyors of the information that is at our core business. Technologists doesn't matter, but our attitude most certainly does. An Indiana State Radio Museum is to get a permanent home in Legionnaire, Indiana. After a 5-year search, the Indiana Historical Radio Museum has found what it hopes to be a permanent home. The association's collection of radios and radio-related material will be exhibited in a building that should remind visitors of the period that museum curator Fred Schultz calls the Golden Age of Radio, the 1920s and the 1930s. From 1975 to 1989, the museum was located in the Auburn Core Duesenberg Museum in Auburn, Indiana. Though work is yet to begin on the new museum, it should be opened in the summer of 1995. The building the museum will call home on Indiana 5 near downtown Legionnaire was built as an automotive dealership in the 1920s, according to Schultz. The red brick building with wide eaves and a porch roof that extends out to cover the gasoline pumps in the driveway is on the National Register of Historic Places. Two women, descendants of the man who built the building, now own the building. Concerned that the building would be torn down if left unoccupied, they offered it to the Visitor Center and the museum with a perpetual $1 a year lease. Schultz says the building is in good shape, but will need about $50,000 of remodeling to bring it up to the standards with handicapped accessible restrooms and proper safety equipment. The historic radio group has already begun raising funds for the remodeling and is about one-third of the way toward its goal. The money is coming through donations and fundraisers, such as having Radio Association members attend local fairs to sell popcorn made in an antique popper recovered from a now-defunct Legionnaire movie theater. The Visitor Center will handle the museum's day-to-day needs from its small room in the front of the building, while radios and related displays will have 1,000 square feet of high-ceiling space in the back. The Radio Association has already collected several jewelry store display cases in which to display its treasures. Initially, the radios on display in the museum will come from the Indiana Historical Radio Association's collection, with some of the 150 radios in Schultz's own collection filling the shelves until the society members lend or give other radios for display. The displays will change often, said Schultz. In addition to the radios themselves, advertising signs, brochures, and other radio-related items will be shown. Schultz's Legionnaire Radio Store displays many antique signs, such as the red neon RCA Victor sign that attracted radio customers back in the 1930s. Schultz began collecting antique radios in 1980, soon after retiring from a career as a communications officer with the Indiana State Police. His collection contains small, simple radios from the early days of commercial radio, the 1920s, and grand console radios from the 1930s. He also has some special radios from later periods in his collection. Radios became the center of home entertainment in the 1920s, bringing news and entertainment to city residents and to rural families cut off from the world for long periods, Schultz said. Though some of the early radios sold for $10 or less, some cost more than the cars being sold in the museum's new home. Many were substantial pieces of furniture, too. Schultz has radios that look like grandfather clocks, as well as the more popular console and table radios. Other radios had functions in addition to receiving news and popular programs of the day. Schultz's collection contains one radio designed for smokers, with a pipe rack, ashtray, and compartment for tobacco, cigarettes, and matches. Another radio, the Porta Bar Radio, holds two decanters, plus coasters, glasses, and swizzle sticks. Schultz said many collectors enjoy radios for the memories of days and nights of their youth, not as an investment. The average radio has more sentimental value than monetary value, he says. While the price for a rare radio styled by famous designers may be each $25,000, many radios are still valued at less than $50, even the cathedral radios, a popular style of table radio from the 1930s. Now they only cost between $30 to $100. An interesting article started in the September 18, 1994 edition of DX News Magazine and was written by Mark Conley, WA1IOM, and it was titled International DX from New England. This is kind of interesting for some of those of you that live on the coast and might wonder if there is something to hear on the AM band. International DX, that is reception from stations from countries besides the United States and Canada, is possible from New England in all seasons, although autumn and winter are the best. Static, or QRN, is the main problem in the summer, but it's not usually as serious as a problem here as it is in the southeastern United States. Principal areas of interest for the medium-wave DXer are transatlantic TAs from Europe, Africa and the Middle East, Asia, and the Pan-Americas from South America, the Caribbean, and Central America, including Mexico. St. Pierre on 1375 off the coast of Canada is probably the easiest foreign, that is, non-U.S. and Canada station, for DXers in New England. Use the World Radio TV Handbook, the WRTH, as your main guide to foreign DX. Recent issues of the International DX Digest column in DX News fill in supplementary information about changes in stations that United States and Canadian DXers are actually hearing, as well as programming information and when to listen. The likelihood of hearing foreign stations is affected by the time of day. ionospheric propagation factors related to solar activity, that is, flares and sunspots, and the location characteristics such as horizon blockage, ground conductivity, and proximity to sources of interference and electrical noise. Having a good reference source and a solid idea of what to pursue and when to find it also helps. And, of course, high-quality receiving equipment and antennas are recommended. Medium-wave long-distance skip generally requires darkness along most of the path. Signal strengths are sometimes enhanced when one or both ends of the path are in the transition zone between day and night, that is, sunset at the western end of the path, sunrise at the eastern end, or the entire path in the gray line zone. Transatlantic DX, therefore, can peak up around local sunset in New England, drop off after that, and re-peak around dawn on the transmitter end, that is, Europe, of the path. Location plays an important role in signal strength on long-haul, that is, low-angle skip, needed for good medium-wave international reception. At sunset, differences of over 30 dB have been measured between European and African signals received at seashore sites versus those heard at inland sites. At the beach, stations can be audible with simple gear, portable radios in a loop, that can't be found inland with even a beverage and a top-notch communication receiver. As the evening progresses, skip angles become higher in the coastal versus inland signal strength differences, and they aren't that drastic. The combination of phased beverages, a quality receiver, and shore location is often considered the ultimate setup for the foreign DXer. If it is a permanent home QTH situation rather than something hastily scrambled up on a DX position, all the better. Neil Kazaros had this in Maine in 1984 and 1985. His loggings included Ascension Island, Nambia, and numerous Angolans and Brazilians. You just will not hear those with the run-of-the-mill setup. Sunset openings can sometimes be exploited inland, especially in autumn and winter. But better transatlantic results of these sites will be had around the transmitter site dawn. Use the popular GeoClock computer program, the DX Edge, or sunrise sunset maps or tables. Auroral conditions occur sporadically. High solar activity energizes the auroral zone and causes absorption of high latitude, that is, northern route domestic and foreign stations. Southerly stations increase their strengths and sometimes, at least, for the benefit of the reduced interference. Looking for Latin Americans and Africans will be a primary focus during auroral activity. Many nights are short skip dominated, and finding foreign DX will require effort, skill, and patience, especially when limited by average receivers, antennas, and locations. So what about transatlantic DX? For transatlantic work, the best antenna system is one that produces an N-fire or cardioid, that is, heart-shaped pattern, with a maximum pickup from the east and minimum pickup from the west. Phase beverage, phase slopers, loop versus whip, and other two phase loops at right angles will generate this pattern. A single-wire antenna running from the receiver to the east or northeast, or a loop line to favor these directions, can still produce reasonable DX results, especially at a good location. Transatlantics are on 9 kHz multiple channels. 90% of these are on splits that do not correspond to the 10 kHz multiple channels used in the Western Hemisphere. Tight filters are often required to separate foreign and domestic stations that may only be 1 kHz apart. For example, Saudi Arabia on 1521 and WWKB on 1520, Algeria on 891, and WLS on 890. The more constantly heard transatlantics are those from an area around the western edge of the Mediterranean Sea. Algeria on 891, Libya on 1251, Morocco on 1044, Portugal on 666 and 1035, and numerous stations from Spain, including 639, 684, 739, 774, 855, 954, 999, 1107, 1359, and 1584. Northern Europeans can come in during the better conditions. These include England on 693, 882, and 1215, Norway on 1314, Germany on 756, 1017, and 1422, and also on 1539. Holland comes in on 747. France comes in on 675, 945, 1206, 1467, and 1557. And the Slovak Republic comes in on 1098. Easy lower-bearing Africans such as Senegal on 1365, Canary Islands on 621, 837, 1098, and 1179, and more exotic ones like Angola on 1088, 1115, 1367, and, of course, the BBC on 1197 are heard best during moderate auroral, a bit after sunset from the coastal sites. The Satome VOA relay on 1530 with English language programming parallel to 7405 sometimes mixes with WSAI and Vatican after 0300 UTC sign-on. Middle East Africans and Asians such as Egypt on 1107, Sudan on 1296, and Saudi Arabia on 1521 peak up well around transmitter site dawn. The sign-on of the 1521 Saudi at 0300 UTC is often heard. Italy on 846, 1332, 1575, the Vatican on 1530, and Eastern Europeans, including Bulgarians, Romanians, Russians, and ex-Yugoslavs, are also the best then, too. An extensive treatment of transatlantic DX possibilities is given in an article, Your First 50 Transatlantic Countries, and Then Some, in DX News Volume 61, Number 27, from 1994, June 20th. Beverages are best, but a loop can do surprisingly well for DX from South America, Central America, Bermuda, and the Caribbean. Most of the domestic pest stations are in a westerly direction and approximately right angle to the desired DX from the south. Early evening, just after sunrise, may bring in Brazil, the Eastern Caribbean, and Venezuela. Also look for Guyana on 760 and French Guiana on 1070. Aurora that improves Africans relative to co-channel Europeans affects the Pan-Americans similarly. Shore sites facing southeast dramatically outperform inland sites for the first 2 hours after sunset. As the case of transatlantics, location effects become less critical later in the evening. English language stations are good targets for beginners. Stations on 5 kHz splits are not hard to find. These include Antigua on 1165, St. Kitts on 555, Dominica on 595, Montserrat on 885, also St. Vincent on 705 and Grenada on 535. Mixed with the powerhouse Spanish language Radio Vision Christiana from the Turks and Caicos. St. Kitts on 825 with religion in English, sometimes parallel to 7510 shortwave, often overrides CFJR, YVLT, and WCCO. ZDK on 1100 Antigua with Caribbean, as well as pop music, is sometimes audible with WWWE nulled. Less common are Barbados on 900 and the British Virgin Isles on 780. Anguilla on 1610 is easy. The 690 and 1505 Anguillans are tougher DX. PJB 800 from Bonaire, Netherlands, Antilles runs several languages, including English, in its religious format. Bermuda on 1160 with BBC programming parallel to 5975 and 6175 shortwave, sometimes surfaces through the welter of domestics WSKW, WOBM, WVNJ, etc. that are on that channel. Having a bit of familiarity with Spanish will also help in identifying Venezuelans, Colombians, Cubans, and other Latin America stations. It will also help you to distinguish the numerous domestic Spanish language stations from real foreign DX. The Cuban Radio Rebelde outlet on 600 is probably the most constantly heard station from that country. Venezuelans on 640, 720, 750, and 780 sometimes top the domestics on those channels. Big Colombians include 770, RCN, which cuts through WABC at times, and 650 RCN, which also rolls over WSM. Other languages which may be heard, French from Haiti, Guadeloupe, and French Guiana, and Portuguese from Brazil. South America's largest country, Brazil, has few stations that reach New England occasionally. The most common stations from the heavily popular São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro region are on 860, 1000, and 1040. These are fairly common on Cape Cod, also Cape Ann, and coastal Maine. They can peak around 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. Eastern Time, although audibly as early sunset as possible in spring and summer, when the southern hemisphere has more darkness time. Northeastern Brazilians act somewhat like Africans and are best just after sunset. Don't expect casual reception of these. Domestic killing aurora and high-gain setup beverages at the beach are typical prerequisites. As sunset approaches, big-gun African stations on 765, 1197, and 1349 to forecast potential DX from Brazil and the eastern tip. Later in the evening, Cubans and Central Americans enter the darkness and become receivable. Mexicans are less common here than in any part of the mainland USA. But a few are heard. Your best bets are on 730, 900, and 940 during auroral after midnight Eastern time. Look for otherwise impossible Central Americans then, too. Central Americans are difficult because of a greater percentage of their signal paths are over land than the signal paths over the North Coast, South America. The power levels in countries such as El Salvador also tend to put such stations at a disadvantage to domestics and the major Venezuelan and Colombian stations. Deep South Americans, such as Argentina on 870, are rare in New England, but are possible. Best results are between midnight and 4 a.m. Eastern Time. At certain times of the year, the signal path can fall entirely within the gray line zone just prior to common dawn along the route. This may give signal strengths a boost. There used to be many more splits from this area to act as beacons. Now defunct Paraguay on 645, heard frequently from West Yarmouth, Massachusetts in the 1970s, comes to mind. Few splits running useful power levels survive today. The National Radio Club Publication Service offers reprints of several valuable articles about DXing Latin America and the Caribbean. So what about Trans-Pacific DX? Well, Trans-Pacific DX stations are often very rare in New England. Best reception is about an hour before local dawn during October, November, and December. I'd recommend beverages and a site facing water to the west and northwest. The bay side of Cape Cod from Eastham to Provincetown would be ideal. Look for Australia on 837, Japan on 774, Tahiti on 738, and others. However, don't hold your breath. For those of you that thought you had to get a big DX machine to do some DXing, interesting article in the National Radio Club's DX News magazine titled DX with a Flea Market Radio. Last winter, an old Packard Bell AC-DC table model radio was found in a flea market in a small town in Washington. This For Beginners article describes the radio, its rejuvenation, and its performance as a DX receiver. AC-DC table model radios were manufactured in great numbers before the transistor took over in the home radio market. They were known as AC-DC radios because the tube heaters were wired in a series string with no power transformer necessary. They could be powered by a 120-volt DC circuit, but that seldom ever happened, at least in the United States of America. The radio tube manufacturers produced a series of tubes specifically for these radios. Numerous manufacturers turned out the radios, and while external appearances varied, electrical design was all about the same. Most were 5-tube models, but 6-tube models were also common. The radio is a Packard Bell Model 602, a 6-tube table radio manufactured by the Packard Bell Company of Los Angeles, California. The radio is a well-worn wood veneer cabinet 18 inches wide by 8 inches high and 5.5 inches deep. The price paid for the radio was $35. The tubes lit, but the only sound from the speaker was a 60-cycle hum. Judging by the cabinet design and the tube lineup, the date of the manufacture is estimated to be between 1948 and 1952. The tubes are miniature type, and with the six-tube lineup, there is one IF stage and an RF amplifier stage. The built-in antenna is the usual spiral-wound loop mounted on a fiberboard, which serves as the back cover of the cabinet. There is a spring clip for connecting an external antenna. The tuning dial arrangement is the most unusual. There are two tuning dials side by side, both for the medium wave band, calibrated from 550 to 1600 kHz. There is a sliding pointer for each dial. However, there is only one tuning knob, one tuning capacitor, and the two dial pointers are secured to the same dial cord. So the two dials gave the same frequency readout at the same time. The dial on the left is labeled Southwest and carries the call letters of about 35 radio stations in that part of the United States. The dial on the right is labeled Northwest and has call letters for about 30 stations in that area. Many of the call letters are still current, including KFI, KGO, KNX, KFBK, KGW, KOMO, and KGA. The call letters are placed in the appropriate locations in the dials to permit tuning of the stations without knowing their frequency. However, it seems likely that the dial arrangement was designed mainly to catch the eye of the potential buyer. With the radio at home, it was found that occasionally a station could be tuned, but the audio would fade completely in a few seconds. Also noted were several torn or worn spots in the speaker cone. The speaker was mounted horizontally with the speaker grill in the top of the cabinet, making the speaker a natural receptacle for dust and other foreign material, such as coffee. The 60-cycle hum in the speaker indicated a defective filter capacitor. The electrolyte capacitors commonly used in tube-type radios lose their capacitance over time, whether the radio is used or not. Filter capacitors were mounted in numerous shapes and sizes, and it is not likely that exact filter capacitor replacements for any 40-year-old radio can be found today. Fortunately, the capacitance requirement is seldom critical, provided that the voltage rating of the replacement is not less than that of the original, and the capacitance is approximately the same. The filter will usually work satisfactorily. In the case of this Packard Bell, a reasonable replacement was found in a catalog of the Antique Electronic Supply of Tempe, Arizona. The radio has a number of paper tubular capacitors. These often become defective over time. Replacements were ordered for all of the paper capacitors because they are available at a low cost and installation would not be difficult. Of the six tubes, it was probable that some were in fairly good condition. However, as replacements for all the tubes were available at a reasonable cost, and in order to save time, a complete set was ordered from the Antique Electronic Supply Company. The cost of a set of tubes, the filter capacitor, and the paper capacitors was under $30 United States currency. When the tubes and the capacitors were installed in the radio, it came to life. Brief retuning was done to peak the IF transformers and to reset the dial calibration. The speaker cone was repaired by smearing some small amounts of Elmer's white glue all over the torn spots. It sounds fine. Now, what about performance? The first test of the radio for DX performance was a daytime comparison with the GE Super Radio, with each using its built-in loop antenna. The purpose of testing during the day was to have fade-free ground wave signals only. But because the time of the test was a December afternoon with some skywave signals present, the first test of the radio for DX performance was a daytime comparison with the GE Super Radio, with each using its own built-in loop antenna. The purpose of the testing during the day was to have a fade-free ground wave-only signal, but because the time of the test was a December afternoon, some skywave signals were present. The location of the testing is a semi-rural area on the Oregon coast with no high-powered local stations. With one noted exception, the Packard Bell received every station that was received by the Super Radio. With a strong signal on 850 kHz, the Super Radio could receive KORD 870. Because of poor sensitivity, the 850 signal covered 870 with the Packard Bell, and KORD could not be heard. The Packard Bell was next tested during the early morning hours against the Sony ICF-2010 with a loop combination. Many signals were present. The Packard Bell compared quite well for sensitivity, but it lacked sensitivity again. Between the signal from KGNW on 820 in Seattle and KOA 850 on Denver, there was music fading in and out and a heterodyne whistle on the Packard Bell. In that space, the Sony received a readable signal on 828 from Japan with a man speaking. This was with the Sony using its built-in medium wave antenna. The Packard Bell did receive a fair signal from KMVI 550 in Hawaii. It's time now for Pete Kemp's Radio Roundup, news of the radio industry and interest to DXers. Many thanks to sharp-eyed National Radio Club member Greg Henson for the following information. For people keeping track of numbers, Rush Limbaugh's show is currently heard on 624 stations and the American Forces Radio Television Network. WWRC's Johnny Holiday covered the Olympic Games in Norway for the ABC Information Network. He certainly is a more active sports announcer, but I still remember him from his platter-spinning days on 1010 Wins New York, just prior to their all-news format. Former Redskin Doc Walker has signed on to WTEM 570 as a noon to 2 p.m. sports talker. Infinity Broadcasting has purchased KRTH in Los Angeles. The degree of computer interfacing in radio is really on the move, even in small markets. One Seattle FM station, KZOK, has set up a promotional billboard complete with a giant radio containing a LED display. The display read the name of the record selection and the artist currently playing on the station. Barry Manilow takes his music very seriously. When KBIG Los Angeles wanted to set itself apart from the crosstown rival, KOST, it advertised that the difference was that KBIG does not play Manilow's music. Barry was not amused. He filed a $28 million suit against KBIG. The suit was dropped and KBIG changed its promos very quickly. Steve Shannon and DC Chimes are back on the air in St. Louis on WKBQ. Their first experience in St. Louis was a short 2-week run following their racial on-air comments. The station dropped them like a hot potato, following criticism from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the Urban League. According to the management of WKBQ, the pair has undergone a 3-month cultural awareness course and is now ready to be unleashed on the air. KFI has contracted with Sammy Bruce for a Saturday evening talk show from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. She is now the president of the Los Angeles chapter of Now. WFLA's morning man Ted Webb has signed on for 3 more years. WIOD is moving its personalities around with Randy Rhodes moving to the afternoon drive and the team of Rick and Suds going to the morning drive position. Based on Arbitron data compiled by the Cats Radio Group, country music is listed as the number one format in America with a 16.2% share of the stations. This is followed by urban with 9.3% and then a tie of 8.3% between adult contemporary and album-oriented rock. According to the Radio Television News Directors Association, nearly 500 full-time and 100 part-time news jobs were eliminated during last year, and the budget axes continue to swing at stations all across the United States. In Phoenix, Tim and Mark have signed on for a 5-year contract to continue their popular morning show on KDKB. WDAE in Tampa has become Froggy 1250 AM, playing country hits of the 1970s and 1980s. KURS has been fined for excessive power. The FCC's Jim Bertel says that it is possible that stations may be migrating to the new AM subband in the 1605 to 1705 by this summer. John Chase, formerly in St. Louis at WKKX, has moved on to WDDD in Marion, Illinois. WAGO in Reading, Pennsylvania, is being sued for alleged taking news stories from the Eagle Times and reading them on the air. With the decline of newsrooms, this was bound to happen. The Museum of Radio and Television in New York City is expected to open up another facility in Beverly Hills, California next year. Roger Stark reports at KEEN 1370 in San Jose, country music since 1946 was taken down in January 1 of 1993 because the estate of the original owner of the station and land decided that they could make more money with the land than the station. The land will become an office park. The engineering staff was told to go out and find a place to put it back up. But where do you put three towers? Land in Santa Clara Valley, Silicon Valley, is very expensive, and any site would cost more than the income generated. So a novel situation was dreamed up. The station was moved to the WSJX 1500 transmitter site, and a new four-tower array was designed using existing four-tower directional array of KSJX. On Monday, April 26, 1994, Keen came back on the air as KKSJ, programming an easy-listening big bands mix with the live DJ, an occasional live local newscast, and the ubiquitous Metro traffic. Cook Inlet has sold KBXX in Houston and its other radio holdings and are currently on the selling block. KJJO in Minneapolis has switched from Thunder Country to Classic Country. 83-year-old Eddie Saunders recently celebrated his 50th anniversary on the air, having hosted the Sermon in Songs program on WVKO. Wolfman Jack is returning to the live airwaves for a Friday night gig on Washington, D.C.'s WXTR. The show will emanate from the Hard Rock Cafe, and national syndication is anticipated. Jim McInnes has just celebrated his 20th anniversary on KGB. Storm and Norman is back in Connecticut, this time on WWYZ-FM. Dale Reeves, known to longtime Connecticut listeners as the Voice Man, has moved on to a morning slot at WDRE in Long Island and the Philly markets. He's teamed up with Karen McHugh from WHUD-FM. KOHT is switching from an all-Spanish to Spanish programming format. So, what's the difference? If you thought that the Inquirer and the Star publications were just the staple of the checkout lines, watch out. Their parent company has announced the formation of a radio and television division to disseminate their news in another media. WTOP recently celebrated its 25th anniversary as an all-news station. KMOX 1120 has added old-time radio in its late-night slot on Sundays. With the addition of Rush Limbaugh to its on-air lineup, KMOX has moved Nan Wyatt to Sunday mornings. Former KGLD 1380 personality Kurt Warren is back across the river at WCBW in Columbia, Illinois, under the name of Kurt Wallace. Columbus, Georgia, former contemporary Christian station WHYD 1270 has gone to a Spanish format as WTMQ. WGNE 590 is the latest to jump aboard the all-sports bandwagon, while WPCF 1290 has converted to Travelers Information Service. The law firm of Smithwick and Bellum, a communications law firm in Washington, D.C., announces the launch of FCC World, a new BBS featuring FCC documents online, forums of hot FCC issues, and more. We've been featured in broadcasting in Cable Magazine and in the Radio Business Reports. It's a free service. Check us out. FCC World can be reached at area code 202-887-5718, 14.4 kilobaud, 24 hours a day. If you'd like to contribute to Pete's column, he's very easy to be reached. You can reach him via CompuServe at CompuServe account 72376,2557 or on Prodigy at address PFVK52D. On the internet as Pete, P-E-T-E-K-Z-1-Z at AOL.com or on the FidoNet system in the ham, shortwave, or broadcasting echoes. Or you can contact him via amateur radio packet. Pete's packet address is KZ1Z at K1UOL.CT. And that's it for tape number 10. Fast forward the tape, and we'll go over to tape number 11.